And welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Novels, movies, music, comic books, video games, tabloid magazines, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. This is episode 13, and you can find the show notes at ump.fm. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is a man who used to recap shows for Television Without Pity until the inevitable editorial exodus of that team to form Previously.tv, for which he now recaps shows. Plus ça change. He's an old hand of the Incomparable podcast, having been a regular since the show's first year, and also makes irregular appearances on several other shows on the network, including now this one. He is, of course, Mr. Monty Ashley. Monty, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It is delightful to be here.
And despite what you thought in email, you do get an of course. Everybody gets an of course.
Hooray! I feel validated already.
Excellent. So start us off. Tell us what you've chosen, and then give us some context around its release, when it was released, its reception upon release, and why it is generally maligned, and why you think that's wrong.
Well, I've chosen one of my favorite movies, Popeye, starring Robin Williams, from 1980. Now, not a lot of people like this movie because it's, well, for one thing, it's hard to understand any of the dialogue, as Robin Williams has chosen to do the entire thing like the early Fleischer cartoons, where Popeye is always talking down the side of his mouth like this and mumbling things and crazy nonsense. Another reason people don't like it is because it's not actually based on the Popeye cartoons, but based on the Popeye comic strip by E.C. Seeger, which in 1980, nobody was actually able to read. The process of actually creating the script required the screenwriter to go to newspaper archives and read old comic strips on microfilm and say, oh, it says here that Olive Oil has a whole family. There's her father, Coal Oil, her mother, Nana Oil, and her brother, Castor Oil. I'm going to make them big parts of this movie. And then everybody went to go see this movie based on a cartoon, as far as they knew, that consisted of nothing but Popeye and Bluto punching each other over a stringy lady named Olive Oil. And it just baffled everybody.
That pretty much sums it up, yeah. I was, yeah, baffled. I think that's a good way of putting it. I actually didn't know that the comic strip and the cartoon were so different.
Yeah, the comic strip, we now know, or at least I now know, is crazy and inventive and does all sorts of weird things. Luckily, here in the 21st century, we live in a golden age of comic strip reprints. Fantagraphics has these amazing, huge hardcover reprints of E.C. Seeger's stuff, and you can see what happens when Popeye and Castor Oil go off looking for a magic chicken, which happens pretty early, and Popeye gets shot over and over again, and it makes no difference to him. And just the craziest stuff happens in this comic strip. And it was apparently very popular back when it was a comic strip, back in, I don't know, actually, the 1920s and 30s?
I was going to say, was it Depression era? Because they did make reference to that in the movie.
Yeah, I believe it was. But then obviously a cartoon was made out of it, and the cartoon was popular and was rerun continuously. If you were the right age to go see Popeye, the 1980 movie, you probably grew up watching cartoons on television, watching Bugs Bunny and Tom and Jerry and Popeye, and possibly being a little disappointed whenever it was a Popeye because they weren't as good as the other two. The reason this movie exists in the first place is that famous Hollywood nutcase Robert Evans went to see Annie and thought, this is a great play. I'm going to make a movie out of it. And then the next day found out that several other people were bidding for that. So he said, what other comic strips can we make movies out of? And it turned out Paramount had the rights to Popeye, and just on the logic that they were making $75,000 a year off the Popeye the Sailor song, he said, well, this is America's favorite hero.
Wow. Yeah, I read a little of that on the Wikipedia page, I think, when I was looking this up. Robert Evans, man, yeah. As you say, like famed Hollywood nutcase is a very good description of him. It doesn't surprise me at all that Fantagraphics are the ones reprinting the early Popeye strips. They do such good work on that score. I was one of those people who grew up watching Tom and Jerry and Bugs Bunny and the Popeye cartoon, and I did go to see this in the cinema. Now, I haven't seen this movie, since I saw it in the cinema. And I was young. I was a young child, but nevertheless, I was old enough to go and see it in the cinema. And the only thing that I remember, my mother took me, and honestly, my only memory of this entire movie is A, being bored, and B, Popeye on some sea rocks at the end. That was literally all I remembered of this movie. I remembered nothing else until I watched it in preparation for this. And now, Monty Ashley, I hate you.
What?
I hate you with the fire of a thousand suns. This film is so bad.
Perhaps I can explain the reasonings that led to this movie happening.
Please do.
One of the things I like about this movie, well, one of the reasons I like this movie is that I have read this book I have here called The Popeye Story, which is subtitled How It All Happened, The People, The Place, and The Events. It's a thorough book on the creation of the movie Popeye. But what's great about it is that this isn't one of these modern day oral histories where they explain where everything went wrong. This came out in 1980, so every decision is described as, and here's another genius thing we did.
Oh, wow.
So the creative team behind Popeye would normally never work with Robert Evans in a million years. It's directed by Robert Altman, who early in the 1970s had done a string of just brilliant movies. You got MASH, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and Nashville. But Nashville was in 1975. And between 1975 and Popeye, which they were shooting in 1979, he was doing movies like Quintet, which I don't know.
I was going to mention Quintet myself, yeah.
Quintet is a super, super slow-moving science fiction movie that is the sort of thing that Star Wars kicked out of the movie theaters.
Starring Paul Newman.
Yeah.
It's an excellent movie.
It is.
Well, I think so. Maybe I should come on my own show and talk about Quintet. I don't know.
It's good. It's also, I stand by this, very slow-moving.
Oh, yes, yes. No denial of that, yeah.
So they got Robert Altman to direct it. Then they said, who's going to write this script? We need a script for a movie, a musical about Popeye. Again, just on the logic, there's a musical about Annie. And they said, let's get a cartoonist to write this movie based on a cartoon. And they hired Jules Feiffer. Now, Jules Feiffer is a great cartoonist. And apparently he's written a couple of plays and even a couple more movies. But he's not a big budget movie guy. And he was the one who said, well, I'm not really interested in the cartoons, but I really like this old comic strip. And it was entirely his decision to base everything on the E.C. Seeger stuff.
Oh, wow.
Then they decided they needed songs. Some people would hire, like, Menken and Ashman. Maybe not in 1980, but you get the idea. They'd hire Broadway people. These people hired Harry Nilsson, who basically specializes in a non-melodic, noodly kind of tuneless song.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind.
Not the guy that you immediately think of let's make a bombastic, fun comedy musical.
Right. You think of him as the guy who did Skidoo and hung out with Ringo Starr. So my thesis is that the creative team of Altman, Feiffer, and Nilsson would be great for a small independent film. But then you cram them together with Robert Evans, who said, we're doing this up big. We're not going to shoot this on a soundstage. We're going to go to Malta and build an entire city. And that city is still there, which means they actually built houses instead of just putting up fronts.
I think that was the thing that surprised me the most when I looked into this about the set. Yeah, was that it is still there as a tourist attraction. It's apparently a very popular tourist attraction. And you can go in the houses. The houses are all houses. They're not just facades with beams holding them up at the back. It was just, I couldn't believe that. They actually built, what madness is this?
Well, Robert Altman had a vision for this movie. And that's what I think elevates it above your usual big budget nonsense movie. And I'm going to read, if I may, from the back of The Popeye Story. We're telling the story of how Popeye becomes Popeye. When he first comes into Sweet Haven, he is very real, a sailor, an orphan looking for his father. We had the idea that everyone that came into the harbor would never get out. When you enter there, you enter this cartoon world. So, and I freely admit this does not come across in the movie at all.
Not at all, no.
It's an origin story.
Oh, well, I got that, certainly. In fact, I wondered, is this the first instance of someone grittifying a beloved kids property for the movies? Because I didn't remember this, that this movie was so, it's kind of dark and grim in a lot of places. And thinking of what came afterwards, especially with obviously things like the Batman movies are probably the most famous example. But now it's a joke. It's become a joke that you take a beloved kids property, a superhero, a cartoon, a comic strip, whatever, and make it all grim and gritty. You know, the very phrase grim and gritty within comic circles is a joke. And yeah, I thought, is this the first time that somebody did that?
I don't think that was their goal.
An unhappy accident then.
Yes. They went to a lot of effort, apparently, to make sure all of the colors in the town were bright and cartoony. And then Popeye is supposed to come in and look normal. And then slowly over the course of the movie, his clothes change to match the palette of the rest of the movie. I've watched this movie a lot, and I can't detect any trace of that actually happening.
Right, yeah, I was just going to say, maybe my sight's going, because I didn't see that at all.
But they're very proud of their attempt to do that.
Wow.
I think their idea is that he comes in gritty and and stays goofy.
The thing that really gets me about this, I mean, this movie took me 4 sessions to watch. I couldn't sit through it for more than 20, 25 minutes without wanting to switch it off. It was just amazing. And I found a quote from Pauline Kael about Altman. She said, he can make film fireworks out of next to nothing. I'm thinking, he sure didn't hear, did he? And maybe this comes from being a creator myself, but I always assume that creative decisions are deliberate and considered, not mistakes. Some people, you know, sometimes will see something that they think doesn't make sense and they'll think, oh, that's a mistake. My experience is that that's not the case. There are very few actual happy accidents and mistakes in most creative work. You get ad-libs from actors and stuff like that in a movie especially, but there's an old line that the final draft of any screenplay is written in the editing suite, which I think is absolutely true. And with a director like Altman, I cannot believe that he wasn't closely involved in that editing process, which leads us to the conclusion that he was happy with this, that he saw the final edit of this movie and said, yep, that's the one, print it.
Everything you see on the screen was carefully chosen.
Yeah.
Every character, first of all, every character you see has a name, a full backstory, relationships to the town, and appeared in the comic strip. There's one hermit character who has no lines, but is in almost every shot, always lurking in the background. The women that hang around Olive and Sing, they have names. The kids who run around, they have names. Everything. Like, in the restaurant scene where there's a big fight and all sorts of crazy nonsense happens, they went out of their way to hire circus performers. You've got Bill Irwin there, who's great, and a bunch of the other people from the Pickle Family Circus there just because they can do good backflips and stuff. And none of that's accidental.
Oh, no, it doesn't look it. No, absolutely. A scene like that would have to be choreographed down to the last inch, I'm sure.
Do you know how they did the songs for this movie?
I know that some of them were sung live.
They were all sung live.
Oh, really?
All of the actors had something in their ear, and I think Harry Nilsson was playing a banjo or something, and they were singing along with that.
I'm sorry.
And then after they were done, and they had the audio track, then Nilsson, or later on somebody else who stepped in after Nilsson left in disgust, orchestrated a whole musical track for it. And they did this both so that they could get away with their mumbling thing that they were very proud of, even though it obscured all of Jules Pfeiffer's theoretically clever dialogue, and also because Robert Altman just loves people talking over each other.
Right, yes, that is one hallmark that does occur a lot in this movie, actually, to the point of confusion. I mean, you combine that with, yeah, the strange accents that, like, Wimpy appears to be the only character who actually talks in a normal voice.
Well, that's Paul Dooley. He's a trained actor.
And yeah, you combine all of that, and there were large sections where I literally couldn't make out the words that were being said. It was crazy.
I will freely admit, the first time I saw this, I missed entire songs. The song Blow Me Down, which Popeye sings while walking through Sweet Haven for the first time.
It's barely a song.
Yeah, I did not know that was a song until later, until someone was talking, and I said, I guess he was kind of humming at points during this.
Ooh, look at there. Nobody seems to care. You've got so much to bear, ma'am. Can I blow me down? That's it. That. Oh, it's the wind and air. Just trying to double dare. Blow me down.
And sort of swaying from side to side and clicking his heels every so often to, you know, simulate dancing. Yeah, it's barely a song.
but that's what Harry Nilsson does. Like, if you hire Harry Nilsson, you're going to get this kind of song. And if you hire Robert Altman, you're going to have a scene where a bunch of people are sitting around a table all talking at the same time.
Yeah, the dinner scene, that was so, that could have been so good, and it was so dull.
That's not dull. It's very important. That's one of my favorite scenes, and I will now tell you why, because I feel that you, sir, have unjustly maligned it. I assume you then mat in some kind of fanfare that the name of the podcast has been said.
You say the title, you wins the prize.
See, that scene shows how Popeye is not part of the town yet. He hasn't yet adjusted to the rhythms of the people around him. It also helps establish that Wimpy is always eating, but you get that pretty quickly just from him being called Wimpy.
No, I did get that. That's what that scene was meant to convey, but it took 4 minutes and it wasn't actually entertaining in any way. That was the problem I had with it.
I find the rhythms of that scene very similar to the rhythms of MASH.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Like in the mess hall, when Hawkeye first walks in, there's a whole lot of talking at the same time. And it just shows that Hawkeye is running the conversation and inserting himself, and Popeye can't yet. They even have similar names.
That's true, yeah.
So there you go. It's a work of genius after all.
Now that you've told me about that stuff that's in the book, so much of it makes more sense. Because it starts off so drab and dreary. You know, the music is funereal in places. I'm not a big fan of musicals to start with, I'll admit that. The only musical that I really know and can bear to watch multiple times was Rocky Horror, which I love. But, you know.
You know that's not a good movie, right?
It's a terrible movie, but it's a fantastic piece of entertainment.
Oh, agreed.
And I think that's the thing here. Like, Popeye is a good movie in the sense that it's all technically there. The performances are good. I understand all the little subtleties and nuances and the stuff you just mentioned, but it's not entertaining. At all. It's so slow. It's nearly 2 hours long, for heaven's sake.
You can't be worried about the destination. You're just supposed to sit there and enjoy what's happening. You should be like, when Olive Oil starts insisting that the only reason anyone would make a hat that ugly is as a deliberate conspiracy against her, that's just supposed to be fun. And it is fun.
Well.
Because I say it is.
See, the key phrase there is supposed to be. There are lots of parts of this where you can see that they clearly think, oh, audiences will love this. This will be great. This is all really funny and madcap and chaotic. And I just didn't, I don't know, it didn't come across well to me at all.
The tone of this making of book is absolutely, people are desperate to know how this great movie got made.
The curse of publishing before release, you know, simultaneous publishing,
yeah,
alongside the movie release. I mean, we were, I checked the time code. We were 25 minutes into this movie before you even find out why Popeye is there. Now, you know, I understand that older movies were slower and, you know, modern movies are sometimes too fast. And God knows, I am a fan of subtle exposition. I do it in my own work. I love it in many other works, but 25 minutes before we even know why he's in the movie?
Well, I have to assume their logic was people love Robin Williams, which in 1980 they absolutely did. This was his film debut. Like, he was coming off Mork and Mindy, and people were very excited to see what he was going to do.
Was this was his first movie after Mork and Mindy? I didn't know that.
His absolute first one.
Wow.
The script was written, somehow, for Dustin Hoffman. Well, the way Jules Pfeiffer wrote this was he was worried about the dominant perception of Popeye and olive oil and Bluto overcoming something new. So what he did was he wrote the first 50 pages not about Popeye. It was about a guy who came to town and moved into a boarding house.
Right.
And like fell in love with the girl who works there, or the daughter of the family. And you can sort of see Dustin Hoffman doing that kind of a role.
Sure, but not with enormous forearms and going, hey. Oh my goodness. Did those 50 pages at any point include the reason why he had come to town?
No.
Wow.
And then Hoffman read the script that had been written for him and said, no, I'm not doing that at all. And here's a quote that I love from the Popeye story. For almost a year, Evans hounded the office of Paramount resident Michael Eisner, begging him to reconsider the Popeye project, insisting the film did not need a star. Popeye, known internationally for 50 years, was the only star the picture needed. One autumn afternoon in 1978, a frustrated Evans was once again in Michael Eisner's office. Once again, Evans' heated rhetoric seemed to have no effect. And I'm going to interject here. Imagine poor Michael Eisner. Every couple of weeks, Robert Evans comes in to yell at you about his Popeye movie. That's no way to live.
No, but I think anybody who has had regular dealings with Robert Evans, you know, probably was used to that sort of thing.
Yeah. Michael, Evans said, Popeye is the star. We don't need a star. Why, even Robin Williams could play it. And everyone said, wow. You're right. This guy's perfect.
Wow. So Robert Evans didn't actually originally want Robin Williams for the role.
No.
He just... Oh, wow.
He had seen Robin Williams' name in a magazine or something earlier that day and was just using him as an example of some guy that's on television. It turns out that Robin Williams was, in fact, a huge star on television at the time.
And, you know, went on to be one of the most beloved comic actors of our generation.
Absolutely. Multiple Oscar nominations. Oscar winner Robin Williams.
Wow.
But this was what got people going to this TV star and saying, we have the project for you. Now, put on these giant foam rubber forearms. They weren't ready at first, which is why right at the beginning, he's wearing a trench coat.
Wow. Yeah, the forearms actually, considering the time, they're not bad.
They're not bad. They do suffer a little bit from, no matter how good they look, they're inherently unrealistic.
Oh, of course.
Like, there's nothing you can do to make Popeye's physique work in the real world.
No. Although I will say, I mean, like I say, you know, the performances generally were pretty good. And I will say, Shelley Duvall was kind of perfect casting, actually.
She was perfect. Yeah. She's great as olive oil. She can do the voice. She looks all stringy. She can go, oh, Popeye.
Oh, fooey. Yeah, no, she was great. And she looked the part. And yeah, you know, she was perfect. Bluto. I don't even know the actor they got for Bluto.
He's nobody. He's an opera singer.
Oh, he was, but he doesn't sing.
Yeah, weird, right? Well, he's got that one song, I Mean, the premise of which that he is mean. He's pretty clear about that in the song.
I mean, you know what I mean. You know what I say. You know what I mean.
Harry Nilsson, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, he was cast solely for his look.
Oh, because, right, okay.
The two things I like about this movie. One, I like how many crazy things had to happen for this movie to look the way it does. Like, somebody had to say, we're going to have an animatronic octopus attack Shelley Duvall. And then later someone had to say, the animatronic octopus isn't working, Shelley. Could you just kind of hold the tentacle against your face and scream?
When I saw that this time round, I was reminded of nothing more than Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Bride of the Monster.
I was going to say, and I thought of Plan 9, but what was the movie, the Johnny Depp movie of...
It's Ed Wood. is what the movie was called.
Oh, it was called Ed Wood, yes. Of course. Yes, yes.
Yeah, Ed Wood's movie.
Brain blank.
In the Ed Wood movie, Bride of the Monster, as shown in the Tim Burton movie, Ed Wood, they have a mechanical octopus that does not work, and Ed Wood has to tell them, just hold it against your neck, Bella, and squirm around a little. It's exactly the same situation.
It is, yeah. That's why I was reminded of it. Yeah, Bela Lugosi does exactly that, just grabs the tentacle, thrashes it around himself, and, you know, imagines that... And he does it very well. He fully commits.
Well, I'm not saying he's a very good... He was a committed actor. And to be fair, Shelley does what she can with the situation. But yes.
Yeah, she does. Yes.
Yes, it's absolutely the same thing. The lesson is that mechanical octopuses are not a good idea. And I am delighted that a legendary mistake in Bride of the Monster is also a mistake in Popeye. I would call it a legendary mistake in Popeye, but I don't think Popeye even has the public respect as Bride of the Monster.
Or even the public awareness. And also, this isn't that long after the famous mechanical shark in Jaws had failed to work most of the time. You'd have thought they'd have learned by now.
Yeah, well, of course, Spielberg made wise decisions with his mechanical shark, which was cut around it.
Yeah, don't show the shark.
But by the point of the octopus attack in Popeye, everybody involved in the movie was out of their minds on cocaine.
That also explains a lot. Like, why the octopus is even there to start with?
It's in the comic strip.
Oh, really?
The movie makes so much more sense if you read the comic strip. The problem is, even Jules Pfeiffer had not read the comic strip.
Right, most people had not read it. Yeah, they, as you said at the start, they went into this movie expecting to see Popeye from the cartoons. Yes.
Whereas what they got was, if you have read the comic strip, you'll be like, Bill Irwin, he's playing Ham Gravy. Now, Ham Gravy used to be Olive Oil's boyfriend in the comic strip Thimble Theater before Popeye ever showed up.
This is some deep stuff. This is real comic strip archaeology, yes, that's going on in the making of this movie. My goodness.
It's full of Easter eggs that no one, even in the movie, understood.
Who was that character who keeps chasing his hat?
Oh, that's Ham Gravy. That's Bill Irwin.
Oh, that's Ham Gravy.
Yeah, that's played by Bill Irwin, who's a great actor, very physically gifted, as you could see.
I'm sure I have seen him in more recent... Oh, no, I know what it is. He played a serial killer in CSI.
I'm sure that he did. That definitely sounds like his work.
Yes, like a major one, you know, a sort of series villain level serial killer in CSI. That's it. He's the guy who almost killed... Lawrence Fishburne's character. I remember now.
He also did a great Waiting for Godot with Nathan Lane.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh.
Not a movie, though.
No, but I do enjoy Waiting for Godot. It's a good, very good play. Wow, look at us all highbrow.
I threw that in just so people wouldn't be looking down at me for liking this movie.
So people wouldn't think you spend all your days watching movies like this.
Right. But even though much of what I like about the movie is knowing the background of every ridiculous shot or character, I also genuinely enjoy it on its own level. The dopey boxing scene, I find fun. I like that they went to the trouble of giving Popeye giant calves, too. I think that's a good attention to detail.
That's true, yes.
Which he might have giant calves.
Although my major question while I was watching that scene, because I don't think I'd clicked at that point that this was an origin story. Right. So I was like, why doesn't he just eat some spinach?
Yeah, they felt like they were establishing that early on with the scene where he refuses to eat spinach because he wants to eat carrots instead.
Is that at the dinner table?
No, that's right at the beginning when he's walking to the boarding house.
With the tax man. Yes,
and there's the
tax
man, then he goes up the town to the alleged strains of Blow Me Down, and he stops by Giesel, the shopkeeper who hates Wimpy, and says,
bunch of carrots?
No.
You ain't got no carrots? What are those, prunes?
Boy, I got it. Take broccoli.
I am in the mood for carrots. I need me vitamins.
Boy, I got it. Take spinach.
I want spinach. I'll ask you for spinach.
So, why he didn't say so? For you, each a dollar.
How much is a broccoli?
Nickel, maybe dime.
And a spinach?
Dime, maybe quarter.
Then how come carrots is a dollar?
$1.50. You buy what I don't feel like selling, it cost you $2.
Hit, dead beat. No. This is a nickel.
A pain, but it feels like paying.
So I assume the Taxman is also from the comic strip.
Yes. Everything is from the comic strip except the name of the town.
Really?
Yeah. Jules Pfeiffer invented that it was named Sweet Haven just to justify naming the baby Sweet Pea.
Oh, does it not have a name in the comic strip?
Nope. In fact, he doesn't spend much time in town in the comic strip because he's always off on sailing voyages, becoming the king of a country of idiots or something.
Right. Whereas he spends the entire movie in the town.
Yes.
Mind you, they built it probably at no small expense. So
huge expense. Like that's the Robert Evans influence where he said, we're going to make a big, huge musical.
Yeah, you have to think, what was the budget? It's about $20 million?
That sounds right.
Which I think was probably quite a lot for 1980. And you have to wonder how much of that went on building that village in Malta.
And of course, they then decided just having your own city isn't enough. We also have to have a final scene on the water, which you can only shoot outdoors when the weather's perfect, both sun and not too many waves.
That shouldn't be a problem in Malta, though, because Malta is smack bang in the Mediterranean.
Apparently it was enough of a problem to make them come in 3 months late or something.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Okay. Maybe it was the time of year or something. I don't know. I just know that Malta is famed for, you know, good weather, good inclement weather.
And then, of course, right at the last second, they said, you know what would be great? Let's have Popeye dance on top of the water.
That was very, very odd.
I think that is meant to indicate that he is now fully the cartoon character, although I admit he looks exactly the same as he used to.
Right, and not that he is fully the savior.
I don't think he is. He might be the savior of the town.
I think we might be reading too much into that.
It's hard to read too much into it because there are a lot of intended things. They certainly cast Ray Walston as Poop Deck Pappy because he played my favorite Martian, and they thought it was funny to have my favorite Martian be the father of Mork from Ork.
Is that for real?
Yes.
That's actually why they cast him.
Also, he was right in the sweet spot of being old and cantankerous at that point.
Well, sure. But oh my goodness. He was actually, again, good performance, I thought. Although, is the whole business about, like, you know, searching for his father, is that from the comic strips? Or was that, I didn't think so, because it felt really, frankly, it felt really Hollywood.
Yeah.
It felt like somebody like Robert Evans sitting there and going, he needs some motivation. He's looking for his father, who abandoned him as a child. Not great. I was going to say that, it's probably not surprising that my only memory was that final scene on reflection, because it's only really in the last 10 minutes that it starts to feel like a recognizable Popeye story. The Piper's Periscope trick and the silly octopus, yes, and the fight in the water with Bluto olive oil stuck in the the exhaust pipe from the ship. All of those things feel like a Popeye cartoon, frankly, because, of course, that was all I was familiar with.
Right.
If only the preceding 100 minutes had been a bit more like that.
I don't think you would actually want that. Do you think you could watch a Popeye cartoon for 2 straight hours?
No,
they're pretty repetitious.
Right. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You couldn't. But that's, you know, that's why perhaps making this movie was just a bad idea from the start.
Well, how dare you, sir?
Well, but I think it speaks to a lot when, as you say, this movie was made on the whim of a producer. Like, what do we own the rights to? Popeye, right, we'll make that.
Popeye's basically like Annie. They're both old comic strips.
Well, yeah.
The thing is, there are so many movies being made that make sense. Like, of course they're going to make Superman v. Batman. And whatever it's like, you're going to understand how it got there. There's not really going to be any surprises in that movie.
No.
Sure, there's going to be another Star Wars. They might mix a couple things up, but it's going to be within range of what you think of just from being told J.J. Abrams is making a Star Wars movie.
Sure, okay.
But if you get told Robert Altman is making a Popeye movie and it's going to star the guy from Mork and Mindy, you have no idea what to expect.
This is true. Back, well, in 1980, you didn't anyway.
This is like viewing an there's an alternate world where movies are like this, where every time you go into a movie theater, you have no idea what nonsense is going to be thrown at you.
Which actually is a symptom of 1970s Hollywood, really, isn't it? You know, people talk now about the golden age of 1970s Hollywood, where you didn't, where the studios weren't in control as much as they are now. And you didn't know what you were getting. And people would make crazy maverick movies on a whim and get finance for them.
Yeah. Robert Altman had produced his own last five movies.
Wow.
So this is what happens when you have, I'm going to call him a visionary because I think Robert Altman is one of the best directors. This is what you have when you have a great director like this saying, maybe I want some commercial success, and taking the first call he gets. And unfortunately for him, the first call happened to be from Robert Evans, who just needed a warm body to direct his comic strip movie.
Which is the very idea that this is the movie you make if you want more commercial success.
Well,
because I was, again, as I was reading up on this, and I noticed that it was shortly after he'd made Quintet. So I thought, well, you would have expected that he'd got all of his anti-commercial feelings out by making a movie like Quintet, at least for the time being. So why did he feel he had to make an anti-commercial version of Popeye? But you're saying that's not the case. He actually thought this was a commercial version of Popeye.
This is a big licensed product. Those are supposed to be guaranteed money, especially it's 1980. Star Wars and Jaws have just shown the world that movies can make huge, ridiculous amounts of money.
Yep.
So you say, comic strip movie. All right, I'll make a comic strip movie.
Literally, yeah.
Where do I go? You want me to make it in Malta? All right.
Weather's good.
The cocaine was apparently great. The cocaine is not covered in the Popeye story. It's a somewhat sanitized version.
But it's not even that. You're saying that Altman actually actively wanted to make a commercial movie and thought that this would be commercial and that people would flock to it because of Popeye.
Yes. There were
wow.
There was lots of merchandising being put out, which I assume was the Star Wars influence. It's the only reason I have the Popeye story, that they thought this was going to be a huge thing. And it made a couple of dollars. Like, it did. It made a small profit. Critics were not kind to it because it's, if you haven't read all about how it was made and maybe seen it five or six times, you don't know what's going on in it.
Yeah, it is a very narratively confused movie. I think that's the thing that surprised me more than anything. Like, Altman is, as I said, he's a deliberate director. Yes, he, some of his more famous movies cultivate chaos on the screen, but you can tell that it's all choreographed and controlled and that there is purpose and sense behind the chaos. And while this movie did feel deliberate, I never felt like Altman, this is a terrible, terrible cliche, but I never felt like he knew what he was trying to say with this movie. And maybe he did, and he just couldn't get it across, but it felt directionless.
Well, I think some of that goes to the script, where, again, Jules Pfeiffer is an odd choice for a movie script. His best work is 6 to 8 panels of New Yorkers talking about their anxieties.
Hey, now, come on, Woody Allen's made an entire career out of that.
He makes movies about New Yorkers talking about their anxieties, though.
That's what I mean. Yeah, Woody Allen can make movies out of that, but no, I agree. Jules Pfeiffer was a really odd choice. But again, the edit of the movie is what really determines the story being told. Any director, and indeed, of course, editor, will tell you that it is in the editing suite that the movie is actually put together and the narrative is finally sort of discovered and brought together. And like I say, a guy like Altman, I cannot believe that he wasn't in that editing suite every day working with the editor, because he's that sort of director. Sorry, was that sort of director. And yet, yeah, this just feels, like I said, it felt directionless to me. I mean, apart from just boring me to tears.
Aww.
But part of the reason for that was because I kept looking for things to draw me in. It does feel as if they're relying too much on, oh, everybody loves Popeye, so we just show them things from Popeye's world and they'll love them.
That was the plan. Although, again, what they were showing people was stuff from Popeye's comic strip world. So, like, nobody cared about Oxblood Oxheart showing up because of that one storyline.
Yeah, absolutely true. It could have been so good. You look at it on paper. Robert Altman, Robin Williams, Shelley Duvall, and even Robert Evans producing. I mean, yes, okay, Robert Evans was, you know, probably not the most stable man in Hollywood, but he had the juice.
Yeah, he had some good movies too. Like, he's not...
Right, he made good movies, and he had the juice to get things done. You know, he was a larger-than-life character who could get stuff done around Hollywood. And so... Which, of course, you know, is how this movie got made, as you said. So you put all that together, and yeah, you would think, and they clearly did not spare any expense, and so you would think something better would come out of it at the end.
Because you brought up the editing, I flipped to the post-production chapter in the Popeye story. It says here, the post-production staff worked a 7-day week schedule, as many as 15 hours a day. They dealt with nearly 500,000 feet of film. Most features print about 120,000 feet.
Wow.
They felt that their deadline was a year too soon. They had 10 cutting and mixing rooms all going at the same time.
Wow.
The main instructions from Altman was very few close-ups. The rest of the film is at a distance like a cartoon panel with full figures. With that, there's so much happening on screen that you can see this film again and again and see different funny things. And I think that's true. I will admit that their flaw in their plan was that not a lot of people will see it again and again in order to see those funny things.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's true. There was a lot going on in the background of every shot that was clearly, again, well choreographed and stuff. I did notice, there was a lot of care in the ensemble. It's not like extras were just standing around pretending to read the newspaper.
I think I can promise that if you watch this movie 10 or 12 more times, just enough to where you can understand all of the dialogue and know what the main characters are doing, and then you're able to focus on the background characters, you'll really enjoy this movie.
What an endorsement. Oh my goodness. Wow. Look,
anyone can watch a movie that's great the first time you watch it.
It takes real dedication to watch a movie that's not great until you've seen it 10 times.
I would argue that, like with any piece of art, it is possible for a movie's true greatness not to be visible on the first experience.
Sure.
Now, maybe that's not really true of Popeye, but it could be.
It could be. But you'd kind of hope that it would reveal itself on the second appearance, perhaps, not the 9th or the 10th. Or
how long do you have to look at a painting before you really understand it?
This reminds me of friends who play certain video games, which I shall not name. And you say, oh, how's this one? And they're like, it's a bit slow for the first 20 hours, but then it's really great after that. And I'm like, I don't have 20 hours to play a whole game, let alone the intro to a game. Oh, dear, oh, dear. Monty, do you have any closing statements about this movie?
First, I think everybody should see Popeye just because it's such a crazy movie that people put so much effort into a movie that's not really like any other movie you're going to see. Like, it's a little, in conception, it's a little bit like that Warren Beatty Dick Tracy. You know, the one where they only had primary colors in any shot and nobody noticed because they were so too distracted by the ridiculous makeup and the yellow trench coat. Popeye is a really unusual movie. And I appreciate a movie being willing to be really, really weird for the sake of weird. And it's just not possible that Robert Altman, Jules Pfeiffer, Harry Nilsson, and Robin Williams could make something with no merit.
But they had a pretty good go.
They disguised the merit very well.
Oh dear. All right. This has been great, but I think that's where we're going to bring this to a close. Monty, where can people find you if they like your crazy, crazy thoughts?
I write about television at previously.tv. I'm currently covering Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Arrow. I am also frequently guest on the Incomparable podcast here on the Incomparable Radio Network. And I am also on Twitter every single day at Monty_Ashley. That's MONTY_ASHLEY.
You are indeed. And thank you very much for being on this podcast. And if nothing else, giving me probably the biggest belly laugh I've had in days.
The very idea.
Monty Ashley, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Unjustly Maligned, episode 13, with Anthony Johnston and Monty Ashley. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. I haven't seen a Popeye cartoon, no joke, probably in 30 years.
Well, here's the thing about those. If you want to go look at them, there's two types of Popeye cartoons. There's the Fleischer Studios Popeye cartoons, which are amazing. Then there's the Paramount Popeye cartoons, which are terrible.
Ah, okay. Is this sort of like pre and post Scrappy-Doo?
Sort of, yeah. Or like on Bugs Bunny, there's the last few years of Bugs Bunny that are just really terrible and are mostly just the Daffy Duck chasing Speedy Gonzales ones.
See, over here, because all of our, you know, cartoons from America, well, all of our shows from America are imported. And years ago, nobody really cared about things like seasons and stuff. So we would quite regularly get cartoons sort of mixed up and shown out of order, or they'd run them for a year, regardless of what season they were from. So when you say things like the later seasons of Bugs Bunny, I literally have no idea which ones those are, because I may have seen them at any point during my childhood.
Well, so did I, but then I got obsessed with them and researched the subject.
Oh, okay.
So now I can tell from a snippet of the background music within a couple of years when a Bugs Bunny cartoon was made.
Oh, wow.
Well, they changed the special effects guy at right about the point where I think they got bad. So there's a good special effects guy who did subtle work, and there's a bad special effects guy who puts in a lot of boings and whack, and quack, 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 quack. I don't like that one. One thing I love about this book, it's got so much information in it that I wasn't able to just fill this podcast with anecdotes, but you know, in that final battle when the can of spinach bonks off Robin Williams' head?
You're going to tell me that was an accident.
That was an accident, and it was a real tin can.
Oh, no. Oh, wow.
They had to drag him out of the water and give him stitches. And then they said, let's keep it. And Ray, cackle like you meant to do that.
Wow. Yeah, that did strike me as a bit odd. I mean, I know it's a cartoon and everything, and, you know, cartoon violence never has consequences, etc., etc. But that did strike me as a bit odd that, yeah, he whacked his own son with a can of spinach and then went, oh, what a shot.
Yeah, immediately after the scene where he looks at the picture saying, me son, you go, aw, poop deck pappy has a soul after all. Wham! Take it, son. Really quick, what I love about the book, The Popeye Story, it's written 80% confident that this is a great movie, but you can feel the doubts of the author trickling through.
Really?
The introduction says that as the book went to press, Robert Altman was supervising the scoring. And then there's this. Popeye has already been called the most anticipated film of the year, and by some, the, quote, next Wizard of Oz.
Wow.
Yet there really is no guarantee that the film will meet with huge critical or financial success, or that it will ultimately be deemed a film classic. I do feel certain, however, after countless hours of interviews and observations, blah, 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 that the Popeye project will be regarded as one of the most unusual and ambitious creative collaborations in filmmaking.
They certainly got that right. I mean, I agree with you. I would rather see, and I often say this about games as well, because this is an argument that often comes up in video games. I would always rather see an ambitious failure than the same old, treading water.
Yeah, if people are willing to take risks, you're going to get 9 Popeyes and 1 really brilliant.
And 1 MASH, yeah. Yeah, it's, and I would always rather see that. So I would never condemn anyone, any creator for sort of attempting something that ambitious and then it fails. Well, big deal. You know, we've all got that in our on our resume. Yeah. Nevertheless.
But you don't feel that means you need to watch the ambitious failure.
Hello. You caught me by surprise. I'm supposed to call you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've ruined everything.
Damn it. Start again.